This is Sea Change Radio, with news, interviews, and commentary, making connections for sustainability. I'm Bill Bowie.
And I'm Francesca Rhiannon. To market, to market.
I just came with my daughter-in-law and I bought blue potatoes. I had never seen them before.
The farmer's market, that is. Welcome to the second episode of the Sea Change Radio series, Back to the Future. Each month, our six-part series will look at what we can learn from the past before fossil fuels were dominant. We're looking for practices we can adapt as we move toward a lower carbon future. Last month, we looked at how food is being produced or could be produced using older methods. This month, we look at bringing that food to market.
When you sell direct, you get direct feedback from the customer, which adds value to anything you sell indirectly to retailers.
That's Jim Pitts of Delta Organic Farm talking to us at the Amherst Farmers Market.
This is a place where you can get involved and you can make a difference, and at the same time, you're only going to, you know, eat better and feel more connected to the source of your food.
And that's Margaret Christie talking about the local hero campaign she runs for CESA, or Community in Support of Agriculture, in Western Massachusetts.
These were never, in any absolute sense, subsistence farmers, in the sense that they were only reliant on their own and their families. On the other hand, they were not fully integrated into what we would later come to recognize as a market economy.
And finally, historian Chris Clark tells us how farmers in the Connecticut River Valley produced both for home and the market in the 17th and 18th centuries. That's all coming up on today's Sea Change Radio. On November 9th, two whistleblowers from the International Energy Agency, or IEA, dropped a bombshell. They said the world is much closer to running out of oil than official estimates admit. That means peak oil is here, or coming very soon. It'll affect everything, but our globalized food system will be among the hardest hit. Aside from using oil to make pesticides and fertilizers, crucially, it depends on oil for getting food to market. Building robust local food systems is ever more necessary. That's something CESA has been doing since the early 1990s. I know, I was involved in the earliest meetings back when I was serving on a coalition of farmworker advocates. Margaret Christie has been at CESA since 1995 and started its wildly popular Local Hero campaign. Now she's the organization's director of special projects. I asked Christie to tell us why CESA got started.
There were a group of people who were working on projects related to agriculture in the valley, and they started meeting just to kind of exchange ideas. They had regular brown bag lunches, and then they thought, what could we do? How could we work together more effectively to address the challenges to a more sustainable agriculture in the valley and making sure that agriculture would stay here for a long time to come?
And what are those challenges?
There's a whole range of challenges. Farmland's very expensive here. It's under a lot of pressure from development. There's lots of people who want to live here. And part of the reason they want to live here is that they like the quality of life that the agriculture contributes to, and open land, working land, lots of really great fresh food. But that means that it's more challenging to farm here. And the agriculture, like everything else, is part of the global economy now. And we can get whatever we want from anywhere at any time. And so farms here need to compete with those challenges as well.
What is the vision of CESA?
CESA works to strengthen agriculture in the Pioneer Valley of Western Massachusetts by connecting farmers and community. So we feel that agriculture is an asset to all of us that live here, and that all of us can play a part in strengthening and supporting agriculture in the valley. And there's lots of ways to do that. One way to start is just by buying local food and other farm products. But there's all kinds of events on farms that you can go to. There's other ways you can support farms. You can support the organizations that work to support farms. CESA's sort of flagship program is the Local Hero campaign, Be a Local Hero, Buy Locally Grown, which has been in operation since 1999 and is a promotional and educational campaign to remind people that they want to support local agriculture, that they want to buy products from local farms, and to help them find those products.
So, and how do you do that?
One of the things that we found when we started that campaign, we did some market research, And we found that people really understood the connection between supporting local farms and supporting their own community and the local economy. So then this was long before there was as much talk about local food and farms as there is now. And it turns out that research has been replicated now all over the country, and people everywhere really understand that connection. So it's not that they need to be taught or educated about that, but when you're in the grocery store at the end of a long day and you've got your kids and you've got to go home and make dinner, you might need some help remembering it and also identifying local food. So we do advertising. We go to events. We wear silly vegetable costumes. We publish a farm guide. We have an online farm guide at buylocalfood.org. And then we do point of purchase material. So we have a very visible round yellow logo that people can use to find local farm products.
And how has this impacted local farmers?
You know, farmers tell us that it makes a difference for them. We have a growing membership of farmers. They pay dues every year to participate, and they tell us that it has affected their bottom line. And I think, CISA, ours was the first buy local program in the country, and it's very visible. So I think it's helped to create the climate of support for local farms and local food that we're now seeing all over the country. Now, certainly there were other people, you know, contributing to that. But I think our campaign has been an important part of that.
As you say, there are a lot of pressures on farmers here. Loss of open land, competition with the global food system, increase in fuel prices that has affected everything on the farm. In creating this local food system, is it possible to create a robust enough infrastructure to have a local food system that if we get to the point of needing to pull back from the global marketplace, that infrastructure will be there, that we'll actually be able to support ourselves with a local food system here in Western Massachusetts?
Well, that's a very interesting and a big question. There are certainly gaps in our infrastructure for getting food from the farm to the table. And that's something that we've begun to work on at CISA in the last couple of years. Particularly, for example, there's not a lot of options for dairy processing. There are some options, and there are some farms like Maple Line Farm in Hadley that have created processing on their own farm so that they can do that. But there's not a depth of options. There are not very many options for slaughter and meat processing. We don't have a lot of options for processing vegetables and fruits in the way of freezing and that kind of stuff. So there are real gaps in our infrastructure. I think we have the potential and the interest to fill those, and we're working in a number of ways. We've done research and sort of pre-feasibility work on several of those issues that I just discussed, and we're beginning to work on a couple more. We're looking at winter storage options, either on-farm or joint winter storage options, so that crops that we grow here and that we could eat all winter if we had good places to store them can be more easily available throughout the winter.
What might have been an earlier time, individual family root cellars you're
exactly,
talking.
Exactly. And we talked to lots of people about how to store those products in their own home. There's a growing interest in winter eating, local eating. There's a growing number of winter farmers markets and people, you know, winter CSA shares and lots of rain, you know, lots of options for eating local year-round. So we help people figure out how to do that in their own homes, but farmers are also interested in doing it on their farms. Some buyers are interested in doing some storage, you know, either at a grocery or at a hospital. They're looking into this, and so there's a lot of interest in that. There's a lot of reasons to move to a more local food system, and whatever the end point, you know, wherever we're going, which none of us really know, strengthening, making a more robust food system here helps us in the short term and could help us in the long term sort of regardless of, you know, what happens. And so I think the steps that we take could benefit us right away and could benefit us in the long term.
Now, one of the issues I think that often comes up is the issue of affordability. I went to the Amherst Farmers Market the other day, and I was happy to pay the dollars knowing they were going directly to the farmer, but the food was really expensive, certainly out of the budget of lower income, working class people, much less the poor. How do we address the economic equity issues in a local food system, given that the cost of growing good quality food is high?
I think that's an enormously important issue. Our feeling at CISA is that this, you know, locally grown food is the best food there is, and that everybody who lives in our region should have access to that food. And there are definitely challenges to making that happen. There's a lot of people and organizations that are interested in addressing those challenges. And there's quite a lot of different ways to do it. The Food Bank of Western Massachusetts works in a number of ways to make sure that they have locally grown food in their food stream that goes to food pantries and shelters and those kinds of organizations. They see working with local farmers as a way to do important economic development in the region, which they see as part of their mission of addressing the problem of hunger as well. We at CESA have had a senior farm share program that provides a share of the harvest to low-income seniors. The funding for that program from the state has been cut, but we have asked the community to step forward and help us keep it going until a point when we expect that, you know, we hope that eventually we will be able to return to some state funding for that program. And one of the things that's valuable about that program is we work with wonderful senior centers around the region in carrying that out, particularly a senior center in Springfield and one in Holyoke. And we have found that farmers, when they're driving their senior farm share produce to those cities, which are further than they may sometimes drive, that then they can do a delivery to someplace else, or they could go to a farmer's market there. And because they know they're going to get the senior farm share money, coupling those things makes it possible for those farmers to do that delivery.
Building local capacity to process food is another area CESA is thinking about.
We've been looking at infrastructure possibilities, and there are other people in the region who are also looking at infrastructure. We have a number of people working on wheat production and processing, which CESA hasn't been directly involved in, but we certainly talk to those folks and try to learn from each other's experience. There's a couple of organizations in Massachusetts that have worked very hard to build a mobile poultry processing unit. And one of the things that they've learned is that there are a lot of regulators in the state of Massachusetts who want to make sure that things are done right according to the particular standards of their office or the concerns of their office. So figuring out how to do that in a way that's streamlined and works for farmers can be tricky. It took years and years for those folks to work through the regulatory challenges in building the mobile poultry processing unit. It was developed by the New England Small Farm Institute in Belchertown and the New Entry Sustainable Farming Project, which is based at Tufts University and does a lot of work with new and immigrant farmers. We are at CESA going to be looking in the next year at the possibility of replicating a mobile quick freeze unit that they have one in Vermont. The Department of Agriculture in Vermont built one, and it can freeze berries and some vegetables. So it can travel from farm to farm, freeze your surplus produce, which you could later distribute in a winter CSA share or sell to a retailer or sell at your farm stand so that people have produce, local produce in the winter.
So now that there's a growing local food movement, we even have a word, locavore, for people who eat locally or try to eat as much as they can locally. What do you see as the major successes and the major challenges facing the development of a local food system here in Western Massachusetts?
Well, I think the major success is that lots and lots of people are talking about this and thinking about it. And people have really recognized that this is a place where you can get involved and you can make a difference. And at the same time, you're only going to, you know, eat better and feel more connected to the source of your food and find more pleasure in what you eat. So I think that's a tremendous success and a wonderful thing for all of us. I think we've addressed some of the challenges. I think there are infrastructure challenges. I think there are regulatory challenges. And I think creating a food system that feeds all of us in our region is very important.
Margaret Christie of CESA, community involved in sustaining agriculture. Thanks so much for talking with us here at Sea Change Radio.
You're welcome, Francesca. It was a pleasure.
You can find a list of local farmers markets as well as more information about the Local Hero campaign at CESA's website, buylocal.org. You're listening to Sea Change Radio, and you're hearing the second in our six-part series, Back to the Future. It's about what we can learn from the past as we move into a low-carbon future. Talking of farmers markets, let's pay a visit with Jim Pitts of Delta Organic Farm in Amherst. We found him at the Amherst Farmers Market on a recent sunny Saturday afternoon. He was there selling pancakes made entirely of local ingredients, locally made pancake mix, maple syrup, yogurt from Sidehill Farm in Ashfield, Massachusetts, and compote he makes himself. I found him spreading the local vore gospel to a customer.
It's easy to eat all your meals locally if you just try, and it's so good. Bye-bye.
I was eyeing the last pancake, but it was cold, and Jim had been saving it for himself. But he gave me a little taste of his homemade strawberry rhubarb compote. Mmm. Oh, that compote is wonderful.
The compote I make, and I came to the conclusion that, you know, I used to sell all perishable stuff fresh. Strawberries and rhubarb, and then after it, the season was over, and, you know, and very often I had more than people could buy, more than I could harvest and sell and so forth. And so I said, shoot, let's can it, and it'll last for months. And the other thing was the pesto, which I've been working on for years and years.
Like many small farmers, Pitz's business model includes adding value to the produce he grows, like the compote and the bed and breakfast conference center he runs on the farm. In addition to selling at farmers markets, Pitt also sells to local grocery stores. Now, it sounds like you've been able to make a success of being able to market your goods locally. Tell me, what is the importance of the farmers market, like here, the one in Amherst? What is the importance of farmers markets for you?
I could sell all this stuff through retailers, but when you sell direct, you get direct feedback from the customer, which adds value to anything you sell indirectly through retailers. I want to be in this business, so I want to know what my customers want, not hearsay from the retailer and so forth. And it's a higher margin when you sell it directly, and it's more satisfying to see somebody that their face light up and say, man, this is the best pesto. Or, I haven't had a piece of pie like that in years.
One of those customers is Letitia LaFollette. She comes to the market every weekend because...
because I can get things here that I can't get elsewhere. For example, the best arugula at the place behind you. And the goat cheese. Those are the things I come for, generally. And I freeze the goat cheese over the winter. It's also a very social place, and on a sunny day like today, it's great.
Letitia LaFollette of Amherst, Massachusetts. And at the top of the program, we heard another market goer, Charlene Fenskoy. Next up, we find out about the historical roots of the local food system now being revived in the Connecticut River Valley. Back when our nation was still new, most people lived on the land. There's the iconic image of the American yeoman farmer, a rugged individualist, eking out a living on the soil with his hardworking wife and kids beside him. But how much of an individualist was he? Social historian Christopher Clark says those farmers were closely integrated into a rural community dependent on barter, social relationships, and local markets. Clark has written about the transition of the Western Massachusetts economy from mostly subsistence to mostly market-based in his book, The Roots of Rural Capitalism. It looks at how rural New England changed in the 8 decades between the Revolution and the Civil War. He says that at the start of that period,
Farmers and other rural people were relying on a system of production that they had developed during the colonial period that had been associated, of course, with the European settlement of the Connecticut Valley and other parts of New England, a system of somewhat diversified farm production that was designed to secure their own family needs, both for food and other materials for their own subsistence, but also the ability to reproduce their farm economy, that is to take up new land, to carve out farms for their children and so forth.
The distinction between a subsistence rural economy and one that produced for market wasn't hard and fast even in the earliest days.
These were never, in any absolute sense, subsistence farmers, in the sense that they were only reliant on their own and their families. On the other hand, they were not fully integrated into what we would later come to recognize as a market economy. They were doing both, and in between those spheres of market and what historians often call subsistence, there was an important area of neighborhood or local exchange, which was also a very important part of their economic strategies.
A typical successful farming family in the late 18th century would
grow a variety of crops and also would be keeping livestock, would attempt to fulfill some of its subsistence needs from its own supplies, but would also be trading goods and, equally important, labor with neighbors and other connections in the region, and would also be shipping some goods of their own production off to more distant markets, either to towns, you know, larger settlements in the region, or down the Connecticut River to Connecticut, where often goods like that got shipped out to the West Indies, or to Boston.
There was currency then, but it was scarce in the 18th century, so
a good deal of the neighborhood exchange that is taking place took place without a specific intervention of cash. A great deal was done on credit using book accounts. You know, you come across to my house and you work for a day laboring in my field, and I make a record of that, and then maybe I send my son to help you on another occasion, and that gets noted. And over a long period of time, sometimes over years, these accounts pile up one against the other, and then at some point we agree to come to a settlement and see, you know, where we stand in relation to each other. One of the objects being to achieve a balance between what we do so that neither of us ends up having to find, you know, cash or something scarce in order to settle an account.
And would this really just be a labor-based exchange, or was there some way in which labor and goods were also equated?
Yes, it involved labor and goods and services of various sorts for which monetary values were given. Various things are going on in the late 18th century that help to bring about change. Some of them are changes that take place outside the rural area. In other words, there are changes in Atlantic commerce, changes in the relative importance of towns, port towns, particularly like Boston and so forth. So at some level, there is demand and commercial development in those areas. And, you know, in the generation or so before I and others were writing about this, there was a tendency to assume, I think, partly because people hadn't paid a great deal of attention to what was going on in the countryside, that those changes outside sort of reached in and altered local economies, in a sense, from the outside. And people talk about market penetration or the urbanization or the growth of transport links and so forth, which seem to be projected outwards from metropolitan cultures into a rural hinterland, which then gets forced to change in some ways. And one of the things that I was trying to do in the book was to show how, even as those things were going on, there were also very important pressures for change that were taking place within the rural economy itself. And those were a number of things. First of all, simple population growth. If you take the Connecticut Valley counties of Massachusetts between 1790 and 1820 alone, the population grows by about 40%. Secondly, because the process of settlement and carving out of farm and farmlands has been progressing over the previous century and a half, is reaching a certain critical point, the ability of families, many of whom have considerable numbers of children, many families find it harder than it had previously been for them to reproduce their way of life for the succeeding generation. It's harder to carve out farms for all your sons, for example.
And out-migration also happened both north and west, the so-called Yankee diaspora. That was the first thing.
Secondly, people move to the cities, or they move to, you know, young men run off to sea and things like that. Thirdly, people start doing more in their local environments, and this is where the real change comes about. They develop new farming methods, they adjust the ways they run their farms, and they take on, in the late 18th and early 19th century, they start doing more in their households as well. Household production of various types of goods which gradually get taken over by factory production or workshop production and of a more capitalist organized kind, but which at first at least are often carried out in households.
I asked Christopher Clark what lessons we can draw from the past, from this resilience of an earlier time that was able to blend a living local economy with the larger one outside it.
I mean, clearly there are important parallels. I mean, even as the market economy develops, I mean, one part of the market or the development of the market for 19th century farmers was the growth of relatively local centers of demand for goods that they would produce. And in a sense, that became intensified because there was increasing competition from other regions of the country for production of certain of the goods that they had produced, grains in particular. So part of the adaptation relates to things that would be congruent with a relatively low energy pattern today.
What are some of the things that we could learn about how they did things? And also, you know, how they did things not just in terms of money, but in terms of those informal structures of exchange that they did.
Well, even in the mid-19th century, okay, when a national market has really developed and these people are, to a greater extent than before, integrated with it, they're doing various things. They do grow certain crops. I mean, tobacco is the classic one in the Connecticut Valley, which are part of a global economy. So that's an example of where they are fully engaged in what is effectively an international market. They're producing other goods, particularly dairy produce of various kinds, which seek a regional market. And then many of them are also now, where they can, producing small fruits and other crops, which are essentially, and vegetables, essentially truck crops, much of which are for local or regional sale in local towns. And so they're doing several different things, even as the market has developed much further than it had 60 years before. From the past, we do learn that institutions and practices, and by institutions I don't just mean organizations, but I also mean the practices that people have in their lives, do help shape patterns of economic development. And I think probably a great deal probably can be achieved by also relying on local and neighborhood cooperative and other institutions and practices to find practical ways of achieving what you're trying to do at a local level. I suspect that an answer will lie in a combination of those things.
Dr. Christopher Clark teaches history at the University of Connecticut. You can find a link to his book, The Roots of Rural Capitalism, at seachange.net. You can also find a link there to the entire interviews with Christopher Clark and Margaret Christie. Our six-part series, Back to the Future, is made possible by a grant from Mass Humanities. Visit the series webpage at seachange.net.
Thanks for listening to Sea Change Radio. This week's show was produced by Francesca Rhiannon.
Our theme music is by Sanford Lewis.
Check out seachange.net, that's the letter C, then change.net, to download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Tune in next week for more on the shift to sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Bill Bowie.
And I'm Francesca Rhiannon.